The big question on everybody's mind. Are you ready for today's big kickoff? I know I am. I've been waiting a long time for it. A lot of years of preparation. A lot of years of blood, sweat, and tears. A lot of anticipation, a lot of preparation. Some hard-fought battles along the way. Some losses, too. All leading up to the one great moment that happens today. The Gospel of Mark. You thought I was talking about something else, didn't you? Today we kick off our Jesus Through the Scriptures Bible reading program, and we are going to be looking at the Gospel of Mark. We're going to start with the greatest story ever told. And that's looking at Jesus. And that's to help fulfill the goals of our elders here at this place, to experience the fullness of Christ, to lead us closer to Christ, to understand Him better. And how better to do that than to look at the life of Jesus, to get to know Him. And so we're beginning in the Gospel of Mark this week. One chapter a day, Mark 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, leading you to Friday. And you will, hopefully, by the end of this week, if you haven't already started, you will hopefully, by the end of this week, find yourself in the midst of a power-packed, fast-moving, action-based gospel. Sometimes we watch these televised sporting contests and this time of year, and we find ourselves being more entertained by the commercials than we do the actual game itself. I know many of you are nodding your heads. But that is not the case with the Gospel of Mark. And so what I want to do this morning is I want to introduce the Gospel of Mark. I want to give you a sneak preview, kind of like commentators and pundits will on the TV and the radio. They will, in the weeks leading up to the big game, they'll tell you what they expect. I want to look through these five chapters that we'll be reading this week and kind of give you a taste of what you're in store for. Mark's gospel, as I said, is action-packed. And one of the reasons I know that, do you know Mark's favorite word? Immediately. Immediately. In fact, in these first five chapters this week, you will read the word immediately 21 times. 21 times. It's like telling you about a red Tesla. You know, you start seeing it everywhere you drive from that point on. And as you read, you're just going to be like, again? Immediately? Again? Because he uses it all the time. But he's moving. Mark's gospel is unlike a lot of the other gospels. It's unlike Mark. It's unlike Luke. It's unlike John. It has been described by many people like a rock rolling down a hill. It is fast-paced, fast-moving. It's almost like the cliff notes of Matthew and Luke. Very, very quick, brief introductions of ideas, and then moving on immediately. And so that's what you're in store for this week. And so what I want to do is just give you a sneak peek, and hopefully together we can get excited about the Gospel of Mark that we're going to get into. So, as we do in all popular sporting events, let's look at the starting lineup. Starting lineup. Who is on, and hopefully you'll permit me to use this phrase, who is on Team Jesus? Who's on Jesus' side? Well, first we see John the Baptist, beginning in Mark chapter 1. The very first introduction that we have in Mark chapter 1 is to John the Baptist. He was the prophesied and promised messenger that would go before Jesus, preparing the way. He's a wild dude. He is wearing camel hair. He lives in the wilderness. He eats locusts and honey, and he's got a leather belt on. I don't know what's so wild about a leather belt, but apparently that was a big deal. John the Baptist had a very important message, though. Repent and be baptized. And then he says that he would pave the way for Jesus, and that eventually there would be one coming after him that would baptize not with water, but with the Holy Spirit. And he's talking there about Jesus. And we'll see a little bit of John here in this reading, but not very much. And as you get into this, you start seeing how quickly Mark moves. Actually, Mark probably focuses more on John the Baptist than he does on a lot of other really important things that he just kind of mentions briefly, skips over, and moves on immediately. But John is on Team Jesus. He is on Jesus' side. But we also see the 12. Here in chapter 1, Jesus meets Simon and Andrew, and he says, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." And we know what they do. They leave their boats, they leave their nets, and they follow him. He meets James and John, says a similar thing to them, and they follow him. In chapter 2, we see how he calls a tax collector named Levi. And all he says to him is, "Follow me," and he rose and followed him. And then in chapter 3, we get into the listing of his apostles. He goes up to a quiet mountain with his apostles. He names them that way. They are essentially the delegation of Jesus. They are his dignitaries in the world. They speak on behalf of the king. And so these 12, he names them there, and they are on Team Jesus. We'll see a lot about them throughout this gospel. Who else is on Jesus' side? Well, the crowd. I don't know, I don't want to get too far down into the football rabbit hole, but if you've ever watched a game where they call the crowd the 12th man, right? They call them the 12th man. It's like they're another player on the team. And what we see here throughout these five chapters, as we're going to read this week, you're going to see the crowd mentioned at least 15 times by Mark. He talks a lot about the crowd. You see the crowd pressing in on him. You see the crowd really comically almost chasing Jesus down, going from one place to the other. And if they can't find Jesus, they have to leave and go and find him as quickly as they can. They're always pressing in on him. They trap him in a house, pretty much. You remember the story? And he's going to talk about that here, where they're basically all surrounding the house. And so the crowd is on Jesus' side here. And that's significant, that's noteworthy, because maybe many of these same people in the crowd, not many years after these events, would be shouting, "Crucify him." But here, in this reading, at the beginning of Mark's gospel, they are on Jesus' side. They love Jesus. They love what he's doing. And he's performing many miracles. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But they're definitely on Jesus' side. So that's the starting lineup. That's who's on Team Jesus. Let's look at the running game. The running game. Now, in any great sporting contest, you may find yourself being very interested in how many yards a team is able to move. And as we look in these five chapters, Jesus is on the move. He's on the move a lot. We know Jesus is from Nazareth, clearly, but we find him in the synagogue in Capernaum, here in Galilee. He's teaching to a bunch of people there, and they're amazed at what they're hearing from Jesus. They're amazed at the things that he's saying. They have no idea how this simple, common son of a carpenter could be such a wise and intelligent person. And it harkens back, I think, to Luke's account, where Luke talks about Jesus as an adolescent, as a teenager in the temple. And all the people are just amazed at how this teenager is so wise and thoughtful. Now, Mark doesn't cover Jesus' early life. He doesn't cover any genealogy. So don't worry, there's no genealogies here in Mark. You're not going to get bogged down with that. But we see how the people are amazed at Jesus' teaching, and he's there in Capernaum teaching. He's also throughout Galilee, traveling all over Galilee as he begins his ministry. In chapter 1, verse 14, after John was arrested, Jesus came into Galilee proclaiming the gospel of God. That's where he's at. He's in this area. But you know what? Maybe like you, maybe like me, he spends a lot of time by the sea. We don't spend a lot of time by the sea, but I think if we had a sea here in Phoenix, we'd probably spend a lot of time there. And Jesus is there a lot. He's there a lot to the point where the crowds would eventually press in on him on the shore, and what does he have to do? He has to get in a boat, go out a little distance from the crowd so that he can talk to them. And that's actually where we'll find Jesus speaking to the crowds in a couple of instances here. And he's spending time there by the sea, but chapter 4 at the end, chapter 5, he travels to Gadara, or the country of the Gadarenes. And that's significant because he travels across the Sea of Galilee. There's going to be a really amazing thing that happens on his journey across the sea. But he goes over there, he pops over there for just a real quick interaction with a persnickety demon, and essentially he gets booted out of the country and has to go back. And so at the end of chapter 5, he makes his way back to Galilee, and he spends the rest of his time there. So as you're reading, not only this week, but throughout your reading, anytime you see a place, anytime you see somewhere that's called out specifically by name, grab a Bible with a map in the back, print out a map, and maybe make a mark, and just notice where Jesus is going, because the running game is part of what Jesus is doing. He's not stationary. He's not stuck in one place. He's on the move. So let's continue and look at the offensive playbook. Okay? Jesus has plenty of plays at his disposal, in his arsenal. He does a lot, even in these five chapters, just this short reading. We see miracles. Oh boy, do we see miracles. Mark is just full of the record of Jesus' miracles. Actually, it's really interesting. In these first five chapters in the book of Mark, you see more miracles mentioned specifically, and then also many of them mentioned generically. But you see more miracles mentioned here in the first five chapters of the book of Mark than you do in all of the Gospel of John. John only records 7 of Jesus' miracles. Mark, at the very least, records 9, maybe 10, depending on your interpretation of some of these things, of the specific miracles that he mentions here. But then he also says that he was healing many people of their infirmities and many people of their demons. And so there's a lot of miracles being done here. And so he's casting out demons. He's healing people of various diseases. He's cleansing the lepers. And then, again, he goes to the country of the Gadarenes and he meets that man with the demon named Legion, casts him out. Where does he cast him out? He casts him out into a bunch of pigs. And the pigs go running off the cliff and frightens the herdsmen and the people there, and then they essentially boot him out. But he's doing a lot of miracles here. And if we are experiencing the fullness of Christ this year, if we are finding Jesus through the Scriptures, you cannot help but be impressed by the power that Jesus has. In just a short, condensed, week-long, one-chapter-a-day reading, you learn a lot about Jesus' power. You learn a lot about what he's capable of and what he does. And it was so important to the people that is one of the great reasons why they were hunting him down, why they were seeking him out, why they almost never left him alone, because he was doing such amazing things in their presence, and they had no doubt in their minds that he was from God. Now, there are some other people that we'll talk about in a little bit who weren't so convinced. Here in Mark chapter 4, though, we start to see Jesus' parables. So he begins speaking to them in some very strange ways. He doesn't come right out and say things very clearly, as clearly as maybe he could. He speaks in these parables, these stories with spiritual meaning. And Mark chapter 4, we see the great, probably one of the most famous parables. The first parable that he mentions here, the parable of the sower. The sower who sows the seed on the ground and all the different kinds of soils and how it takes root in some, how it's plucked out and not able to take root in others. And the disciples, upon hearing this parable, are scratching their heads. The 12 ask him about this parable, and Jesus says in Mark chapter 4, verse 11, "To you has been given the secret of the kingdom of God, but for those outside, everything is in parables, so that they may indeed see but not perceive, and may indeed hear but not understand, lest they should turn and be forgiven." There's a very specific reason why Jesus is speaking in parables, so that he can say something to them and it blows right over their head, unless they're thinking spiritually. unless they're thinking the way that he wants them to think. He is training them on how to listen. He's training them to shift their mindset away from physical things into spiritual things. And as you read this, hopefully you'll receive the same training. Hopefully you'll see the deeper meaning of these parables and not just lose them on the surface and glance off of them, because they are really, really important. He talks about the lamp under the basket here in chapter 4. He talks about the mustard seed here in chapter 4. And so he speaks to them in parables. And an interesting thing about Jesus, and I love that Mark points this out because I think this is really important. In verse 33 of Mark chapter 4, with many such parables he spoke the word to them as they were able to hear it. He did not speak to them without a parable. He didn't speak to them without a parable. Everything he told the people had a twist to it, had a story to it. But privately to his own disciples, he explained everything. Jesus was not very cryptic with his disciples. He needed these men to know what he was talking about. And having them confused as well was not going to be helpful for his mission. And so he needed to explain things to them. And so Jesus is, in a sense, doing some very powerful things in his teaching. And this next one I call huddle up. And it's kind of what you saw there when he's explaining in private to his disciples. But Jesus huddles up. You know when you watch a football game, right? The quarterback's out there and he yells, blue 42, right? And he doesn't, that's probably the first time I've ever said that in public, but he shouts some nonsense word, right? And all the people on the team know exactly what he's talking about, know exactly what play that he's calling for, exactly what he wants them to do. Notice here in your reading that as popular as Jesus is and as famous as he is in Galilee right now, there are a few times where he keeps his miracles quiet, where he performs amazing miracles, healing Jairus' daughter. After he heals her, after he raises her from the dead. Now, Jesus used language like, oh, she's not dead, she's sleeping. But all the people knew a dead body when they saw one. Jesus knew what he was about to do. But after he raises this dead girl, he tells them, don't say anything to anybody about this. And a lot of times when he casts out demons, he tells them, he forbids them to speak because they know who he is. And so in a sense, you see Jesus almost huddling up sometimes, trying to keep some of these miracles, trying to keep some of these amazing things that he's doing out of public view. And it happens here in the first five chapters a few times. But as you roll into week 2, chapter 8, there's a couple of other times where Jesus explicitly tells people, don't say anything about this. You keep this quiet, which seems counterintuitive. It seems like Jesus would want everybody to know about this, but he has his reasons. He has his reasons. There are reasons why he does not want more attention than is needed at any given time. Now, there are some people who Jesus would tell, hey, don't say anything about this, and then they turn right around and go blabbing it to everybody. But Jesus, in general, is trying to keep some of his miracles very quiet. So he's doing a lot. Jesus is on the move. And he's got a lot of tools at his disposal for making a big difference in the world. Connected receptions. Okay, so Jesus connects with a lot of people, a lot of receptive people. He makes some really important connections with people in these first five chapters. So let's look at a few of those here. He connects with the sick and the demon-possessed. All those miracles where he's healing the sick, he's connecting with them. He's interested in them. You know, when he sees a man with a withered hand, he doesn't just pass it off and go the other way. He takes care of the situation. When he sees the Jairus's, who's the head of the synagogue there, when he sees that he comes to him and asks him to heal his daughter, he takes care of that situation. Jesus is connecting with people who are sick and who are demon-possessed. And one of the interesting things that as you read, make note of this too. How many times does Jesus touch people? Jesus uses touch very often in his ministry, to the point where he goes and touches people you should not touch, like a leper. When the leper, and he sees the leper, he touches him. Now, I'm sure anyone in that society probably would have been aghast at that. But Jesus touches him and heals him. Simon's mother-in-law, he takes her hand and heals her of her fever. Jairus' daughter, he takes her hand as she's there laying dead and calls her back to life. And we see the woman who had the infirmity of blood, who isn't touched by Jesus, but just simply touches Jesus' clothes, and she's healed. So he's making connections. He's there in the midst of the people. He's touching them. He's healing them. He's caring for them. He's taking care of them in the amazing ways that he can. But also, he's connecting with tax collectors and sinners. There in Mark chapter 2, when he calls Levi and says, "Follow me," Levi has him over for a meal. And there at the meal are a bunch of tax collectors and sinners. Not people you would expect the Son of God to be around. But notice here, right off the bat, in Mark's gospel, right off the bat, we see that Jesus is not better. He doesn't feel superior. He's not treating other people as inferior. He's there to heal the sick. He says in verse 17 of Mark chapter 2, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners." Jesus had a very clear vision of who he was connecting with. Throughout all the chaos and distraction, he knew exactly who he was aiming for. He was aiming for those who were sick, not for those who thought they were doing just fine. Were the tax collectors or were the Pharisees and the Sadducees, were the religious leaders in need of Jesus? Oh, absolutely they were, but they didn't think they did. These tax collectors, these sinners, were receptive. And that's a big lesson for us too. When we are receptive, when we are willing to receive Jesus, when we're willing to acknowledge that we have a need, then Jesus is there to connect with us, just like he did here. And he caught a lot of grief for it, and we'll talk about that in a second, but he didn't care. This is why he was here, to help these people, not to pontificate with all the religious leaders of the day, not to sit around on some throne. He was there, traveling the running game, making connections with the lowliest of the lowly in their society. Don't laugh at this one. A hail from Mary? So chapter 3, we see Jesus. We don't actually see a whole lot about Mary, Jesus' mother. We don't see a whole lot about her throughout this gospel. Luke, Matthew, they both cover a lot about Jesus' childhood, about Mary, about all the things that happened. We don't see a lot about Jesus' mom here, but we do see her pop up as Jesus is surrounded again by a crowd. His mother, his brothers came standing outside, and they sent to him and called him. So they're out there in the back of this crowd trying to get to their son, trying to get to their brother. And does Jesus feel like this is an important interaction to have? In a sense, in a maybe strange kind of turn your head kind of way, he almost snubs his mom and his brothers. Not in a disrespectful way, not in a sinful way, of course. But what Jesus is showing here is that he's not here to have this familial clique where he hangs out with only the people he's comfortable with all the time. And he goes on to use this opportunity and he says, "Who are my mother and my brothers?" Huh. I love how Jesus asks questions in some ways that really make you go, "Huh? What are you talking about?" And looking about at those who sat around him, he said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of God, he is my brother and sister and mother." You know what he's doing here? He's making connections with those who obey the will of God. He views them as seriously as he views his own mother and brothers, his blood relationship. If you follow the will of God, you have a connection with Jesus in very deep ways. You could say you're on Team Jesus. You're part of the family. And Jesus uses this opportunity to make this connection with all those, anyone, who would obey the will of God. And it's the same today. It's the same today. If someone decides that they're willing to obey the will of God, then they are part of the family. They're part of our family. They're not other people. They're not those people. They're our people. They're Jesus' people. And that's important because that helps us break down all of our prejudices, that helps us break down all of our biases and all the things that the world might build walls because of. We tear them down when someone is willing to obey the will of God. So let's close this thing out then, looking at the defensive coverage. Now, you all know you're not going to be able to win a game on offense alone, right? Well, maybe you can. I don't know. Depends on how much you score, right? But you need to be able to defend against some things. And here in these first five chapters, we see Jesus having to play a lot of defense. Right off the bat, in Mark chapter 1, verse 13, we see how Jesus is in the wilderness for 40 days, being tempted by Satan. Now, again, this is another mark of how Mark writes. He doesn't cover anything about these 40 days. You're going to have to go to the other Gospels to find out what happened. And we know that the devil presented him with all sorts of temptations, and Jesus was able to respond to each one with the Scriptures and to correct him. He did not succumb to temptation, but he was there in the wilderness for 40 days being tempted by the devil. And that was significant because that happened right off the bat, right after he was baptized, immediately. And then immediately he goes in and begins proclaiming the good news of salvation. We also see him playing defense against the scribes and the Pharisees a whole lot. And it's not going to stop here. Again, he has to play defense here from these people, these religious leaders who do not appreciate what he is saying. They do not appreciate him. And especially, can you imagine being a religious leader thinking you are the source of all information, spiritually speaking, for the people, and having this nobody come in and garner as much respect and awe, doing as much amazing things as Jesus is doing? Can you imagine how they must have just been burning at Jesus? How much they must have hated him? And they would call him a blasphemer here. They would call him a Sabbath breaker. A couple of times, actually, he heals the withered man's hand in the synagogue on the Sabbath, and they accuse him of breaking the Sabbath there. His disciples, what are they doing? They're out in the fields. They're picking heads of grain, and the Pharisees are there. They're trying to trap him, and they basically accuse him of being a Sabbath breaker. Jesus uses that opportunity to specifically talk about the fact that he is Lord of the Sabbath and that Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So some important teaching he uses there. But then they also call him a messenger of Beelzebul, a messenger of the prince of demons, at which point Jesus talks about how strong he is. Compares himself to the strong man who cannot be overtaken by another. And Jesus is stronger than demons. Demons are not stronger than him. So if you want anybody on your starting lineup, it better be Jesus as the strong man. He's the one who has power and control and authority over all of these forces. But the Pharisees don't appreciate it, and they conspire. A few times they get together, have these conferences about how they can catch Jesus and how they can overtake him in something. And then finally, we see the example in Mark chapter 5 of the frightened Gerasenes. As Jesus goes across the sea, he calls for the sea, the storm, to peace be still, and it's quiet. An amazing thing that happens there. But he gets on the other side, he sees this demon-possessed man immediately, and he casts out the demon, goes into some pigs, goes over the edge, and all the herdsmen get together, tell the people in the city, and say, you better get out of here. Jesus is not appreciated by these people. And so, rather than sticking around, he leaves. He goes back home. He goes back to Galilee, and he continues to do a few more amazing miracles, healing the woman who had the infirmity of blood, raising Jairus' daughter there. But they did not appreciate him. They were a little bit afraid of what Jesus could do or what he did, and they didn't want him around anymore. We'll see that a couple of times where people collectively don't appreciate Jesus. But what I want you to see as part of this is that as you read this week, the crowds are on Jesus' side. He has critics, but by and large, the majority of people appreciate what Jesus is doing. But later on in the weeks to come, we will see that change such that Jesus is called by the entire crowd, crucify him. And so this isn't going to last for very long, but notice it while it is. And hopefully, if you were in that crowd, what would you have been saying? Would you have been praising him as the Son of God? Or would you have been like the Pharisees who were skeptical of him and not willing to accept him? So that's the first five chapters of the book of Mark summarized. And you're going to read a lot more this week, and you'll see a lot of things that we just didn't even have time to cover. But maybe you're thinking, I haven't preached a 5-point, 3-sub-point sermon in quite a while, and this is a lot of information, okay? But even in the things that we've talked about, you can start to see how this is just jam-packed, action-packed. The fact that he uses the word immediately so often here, and the question that I have for you, are you ready to read? Are you ready to get in to the Scriptures? Are you ready to find Jesus, experience the fullness of Christ, reading through the greatest story ever told? By the way, this is only the first quarter or so of Mark. And I guarantee you, I don't make a lot of guarantees from the pulpit. I try not to do that. But I guarantee you that if you tune in today at, 4:30 when kickoff happens for the big game on TV, you will not see as much action, you will not see as much importance, you will not see as much substance as you will if you read Mark chapters 1 through 5 this week. This is packed. And so hopefully you'll do that along with me this week. And if you will, please take out your songbooks and turn to the number that's been announced. Really, the question is, if you haven't given your life to the Lord, if you haven't accepted him, I want to piggyback off of something that Chad said, maybe framed slightly differently. You need to buy the farm. You need to invest yourself. You need to give it all. You need to be a part of Team Jesus. And as he called his earliest disciples, all he had to say was, follow me. And if you think about that, it's not really an invitation so much as it is a commandment. It's an instruction. Follow me. And that's what I'm asking you. Are you ready to follow Jesus? Are you ready to give your life to the Lord? Are you ready to buy the farm? Are you ready to invest everything you have for this team? It takes blood, it takes sweat, and it takes tears. It takes everything you have for that entire time you are on the field of this life. But if you're willing to put out there your commitment to the Lord, then as he said, you can be saved. You can find and experience salvation if you come to him in baptism. If you have that need, please come forward as we stand and sing.